Welcome to Focus on Community. I am Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and we are live on the air on this misty night for this month's edition of a radio program dedicated to informing Southeast Alaska K2 listeners about a myriad of psychological and social issues confronting us in our daily lives. And ultimately, this program is about living our lives with more awareness and greater happiness. Tonight's program is best for adult listeners because we will be talking about sexual abuse. So if parents wish, you can change the station and listen to KXLL at 100.7 or KRNN at 102.7 for the next hour. But for all you adults out there, I think you can handle the topic. For years, I've counseled men and women who come to me for a variety of reasons. They may have marriage problems or are single stressed parents, or they may be depressed or anxious. I've found that a disproportionate number of my clients who suffer from psychological or family problems have been victims of sexual abuse as children or as adults. Although most of my clients do not specifically come to see me because of their experience of sexual abuse, they do come for other problems that the abuse may have caused. Just last month on this same radio show, I interviewed Gary Weglars, a clinician at Search in Juneau. That evening, we talked about an important new study that showed a direct correlation between the number of adverse childhood experiences that a person has had, including sexual abuse, and the number of medical and psychological problems they would experience in the future. So we know it's a very, very serious issue. Tonight's show will focus not particularly on the victim of sexual abuse, but rather on the offender. I found that victims, my clients, of sexual abuse are usually very curious. They want to know why some people become pedophiles or rapists or harm people sexually, and sometimes specifically why their relative or family friend or a complete stranger would do such a thing. And victims or family members may also want to know if the offender can be helped or even cured. Perhaps tonight we can shed some light on these questions. Now, most Juneauites know, of course, about Lemon Creek Correctional Center, but few know that the prison houses a sex offender treatment program. My guest tonight is Malcolm Nichols, who is the program director and clinician with the sex offender treatment program at Lemon Creek Correctional Center. And as I mentioned, our show is live tonight from the K2 studios. And we now have the ability to field phone calls live. We encourage you, if you have any questions or comments, to please call in at 463-6425, and we'll get you on the air without identifying you by name. If you wish even more privacy, you can call the same number, 463-6425, and our operator will write down your question, which then I can read on the air. And yet a third option, you can email us during the show at Jeff, J-E-F-F, at K2.org, and we'll read your question or comment on the air. So don't be shy. Contact us during the show, and either I or my guest or both of us will respond to your question or comment. And so I've kept you waiting long enough, Mac. Welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks.
Yes. And Mac and I had lunch with our colleague Tony Mander the other day, too. I needed some background so I could ask you hopefully relevant, pertinent, intelligent questions. But most important is, Mac, what brought you to Juneau? Because I know you're not a Juneau long-termer.
Right.
What brought you here?
Well, I was working in mental health in Columbus, Ohio, and I saw an ad on the ATSA, the Association for Sex treatment of sex offenders, and I saw an ad there for the position at the prison, and I decided to take it, and so I came up in January 2010.
Okay, January 2010, so you've been through more than a whole yearly cycle.
Yes, right? About 17 months now.
Yeah, okay. You've had quite a history of clinical work as a clinician, mental health clinician, but particularly with in the legal system, with people who have committed crimes and sex offenders. Where did you do that work?
Well, I started off in community mental health in Gallipolis, Ohio, in the late 1980s, and I was given the task of serving the jail and the court there, mm-hmm. and I then developed a jail diversion program. And so the center where I worked then proposed that I go get trained for working with sex offenders, because we had no one to do that.
Yeah.
So I took a certification, a week-long certification in that, and so that led me to developing sex offender treatment in the Gallipolis area for a three-county area, actually. And then I moved on to running a sex offender program for a outpatient clinic in Columbus,
mm-hmm.
and I was the director of that program. And then I went, after 3 years, I went back into managing very high-risk forensic patients who were involved, with the legal system.
High risk because they were murderers or rapists?
Yeah, they had murdered family members and pretty heinous crimes and
yeah.
spent many years in a state psychiatric hospital.
Okay. How do you like Juneau?
Oh, I love it. I love the outdoors. I love the mountains. I love hiking and kayaking.
Well, you more than love hiking. I heard from Tony Mander that you hiked the whole Appalachian Trail, right?
Yes, I did that many years ago, actually, 1979. But
okay.
It was one of the peak experiences of my life. And to this day, I have very, very good memories of it.
Did you do it all at once?
Oh, yes. I set off on April 3rd, and I finished July 18th up in Maine. I set off from Georgia.
How many miles?
It's 2,270.
Wow. Did you get food drops along the way, or how did it work?
No, I sort of went the low-budget route. I bought food at any store that I encountered.
Okay.
And I also got very good at the end at giving a sob story to weekend hikers, and they would give me all their extra food as they were leaving the trail.
Yeah, very good. And also I found out, I was very interested, because I spent some fair amount of time in Morocco, that you hiked the Atlas Mountains.
Right. I did a two-week traverse of the Atlas Mountains in 1986.
Okay.
And,
what's your favorite hiking trail in Juneau?
Oh, I think I really like Thunder Mountain.
Do you?
Going up the front and then going back down, towards the glacier side.
So you have no fear of heights?
No.
Good. You're lucky. And I found out that Mac grew up on the south side of Chicago, just like I did.
Yes, right.
And he grew up in the fancy part, Hyde Park, and I grew up in the not-so-fancy park, the ghetto. But that's
right.
Okay. We're both Southsiders. And we both have a slight accent, probably. So
right. Well, I'm very impressed with where you actually grew up there on
yeah.
Stony Island.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
My neighborhood was the University of Chicago neighborhood.
Yeah.
But actually, in the 50s and early 60s, it was considered to be, quite a bad neighborhood, dangerous place to live.
You mean where I was or where you were?
Well, both.
Yeah. But,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. But, it makes you tough. And, maybe that's one of the reasons why you are able to work with offenders. Who knows? The other thing that we have in common is I think you were in on the bare beginnings of sex offender treatment, and I was in on the bare beginnings of rape victim treatment and incest survivor treatment. Back 35 years ago, a group of women and I started Rape Relief in Seattle, Washington. We were the second rape crisis center in the country. And then I have done a lot of training with incest survivors in the Pacific Northwest. And so that's an area of specialization for me. So I think we make a good team here. That's really great. I just want to tell our listeners that I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and in the studio with me is Malcolm or Mac Nichols, the sex offender treatment specialist at Lemon Creek Correctional Center. And we will be talking in this show about the causes and treatment of sex offenses and other related topics. It may not be the best place to have your kids tonight, and we've got two other K2 stations that you might enjoy more. But let's get down to it, Mac. The big question is, please describe the treatment program that we have here in Juneau.
My program is an 18-month program. It has three primary components. The first component is basically a very long and very in-depth assessment, a risk assessment it's called. The treatment is primarily group, four groups per week of about an hour and 15 minutes. I have 24 inmates in the program. I also do at least a half hour of individual counseling with each of the offenders. I built the program from the ground up. There had been programs at Lemon Creek in the past. The latest one was in 2005. Mm-hmm. And so I used various tools in building this program, some of the older stuff that I had used in Columbus and some of the Colorado program model. And I also used some of the Good Lives model, which is from New Zealand, an approach from New Zealand.
From New Zealand.
Yeah.
It's called the Good Life model?
The Good Life model, yeah.
Can you talk about that later? Or
sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, don't want to interrupt your stream of description
right
here.
So then the second component is the long treatment component. And then the third one has to do with them preparing for release and developing a personal change contract or sort of a combination between the Good Lives model and relapse prevention model.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And putting together what's called a safety net, which are people from their community who will sort of monitor their personal change contract and be a positive influence on them.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of a go-between between them and also have contact with the community PO.
So now, this would assume that then the offender who's released is in the community where they have previously lived. Because how can you do a net if they're in a strange place? Or is that, because don't you have friends and family be part of the safety net?
You can. We can also add them after their release. The community PO can also, add members to the safety net.
But they can be members from a professional position? Because mm-hmm. if someone is not connected to the community.
Yeah, they can be involved in a church they might be attending. They can be a family member. Mm-hmm. They can be involved where they work. They can be, involved in AA as a sponsor.
And what does the safety net do?
Well, again, it provides a level of support. It's very critical for sex offenders when they get out to adjust to the community, being back in the community. And in many ways, they've suffered from sensory deprivation in prison.
Yeah.
And so that early stage of their release is quite a critical one for their sort of ongoing connection to, the change that they've been working on.
Will they sometimes go to a halfway house?
Yes. We do also encourage that because it gives them, financial, economic support with housing and food and so on.
Well, could you tell us about the Good Life versus the relapse prevention model? Models.
Okay, the Good Lives model, well, the older relapse prevention model basically identifies risk and then it works. It was a model that was taken from the substance abuse field.
Right.
And so you identify risk, and then you identify then alternate strategies to contain that risk. They can be, you know, distorted thoughts, attitudes, behaviors, high-risk situations.
Okay. So the individual with, it's seen as an addiction, and that the individual, or a compulsive behavior,
right.
So that the individual learns to know what the triggers are.
Right.
And then to give them coping strategies.
Yes.
To deal with the triggers.
Yes.
Okay.
The Good Lives model also identifies risk, but it comes from the position that sex offenders are trying to meet their needs in deviant ways. Mm-hmm. And so you need to replace that with, you know, more constructive ways of meeting their needs by changing, you know, these risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
And you also promote their capacity to be successful in the community. So if they don't have a high school diploma, then you would promote, you know, studying for the GED. If they have no job training, you would encourage that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would come up with a plan for them also to, you know where they could, let's say, go to a truck driving school, or where they could, you know, learn, get a welding certificate,
right.
Once they get out, so they have a plan.
And you used the term container model when I spoke to you at lunch. What's that?
Actually, the containment model.
Containment.
Yeah. It's
okay.
It's what we follow now in the United States, also in Canada, and Europe also uses it, and, you know, New Zealand, Australia. Basically, it's a management approach to managing sex offenders, starting with the courts and giving sentences that are, you know, somewhat longer, with much longer probation, parole, and then treatment or rehabilitation, either while they're institutionalized or after they are released in the community, and then also close management with the community probation officer, and also the use of polygraph testing.
And how do you use polygraph? Do you do polygraph here in Juneau?
Yes.
Okay.
All of the inmates in my program take the sex history polygraph, which
okay.
is a two-part polygraph that gets into their entire history of sex offending.
Yeah.
And then gets into other kinds of paraphilic behaviors.
And would you like to, could you define that?
Well,
paraphilic?
Like exhibitionism, voyeurism.
Uh-huh.
Things like that.
Right.
So what we find is that sex offenders have a much greater history of sex offending, with many more victims than we initially know. And so this is one of the advantages of this approach.
If it comes out on a polygraph, more offenses, is then that person charged with those offenses? How does that work?
We're very careful in avoiding that. We don't want to, you know, get them into any further trouble. That would put up too many barriers, and it would probably be illegal. So we encourage them to be honest, and we encourage them to reveal this information in a way that doesn't result in our having to report it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very careful at going over that with them.
Yeah, otherwise it wouldn't work, obviously. I just want to remind our listeners that this is a call-in show. We're live. And if you have any questions or comments for Mac or for me, please call 463-6425. That's 463. Obviously, error code 907. 463-6425. And we can either get you on the air. You can dictate your comment or question to our operator, who will give me the written question. Or you can email, if you want complete anonymity, you can email Jeff, J-E-F-F, at KTOO.org, and we'll read your comment and go from there. So we'd love to hear from you, any comments or questions you have about this very, very difficult topic. Now, Is there any outpatient treatment that continues after the person has been released from your program?
Yes, I do recommend aftercare, particularly for very high-risk sex offenders. And my program is focused on high-risk sex offenders.
Mm-hmm. And so where would they get that aftercare in Juneau?
Well, we are currently about to hire a clinician for the community to provide outpatient sex offender treatment to the community sex offenders.
So this would be somebody who is in private practice rather than...
No, it would be a Department of Corrections employee.
Excellent, excellent. Right, because I know that it's pretty scary for a therapist to work in this field if they're all by themselves. What we learned, I remember back in graduate school, because back at University of Washington, both rape relief was beginning, but we were also building women's shelters. And so working with batterers was not a solo private practice thing that we did, nor people who had been released for sex offenses. So I'm really glad to hear that there'll be a departmental position. That's great. I'd like to take a look at some of the, I don't think it would be called causes, but some of the conditions that might prompt an individual to be a sex offender. For example, some people think that being a victim of sexual abuse themselves as a child would make one more likely to be an offender. How do you feel about that, or what do you know about that?
That's sort of a controversial subject. There are a number of sex offenders who have been sexual abuse victims themselves, but the majority of sexual abuse victims do not become sex offenders. So we don't want to, propose that there is a definite correlation.
Well, there's no definite correlation, but there's a higher incidence.
Right.
And that's than the normal population. And it makes sense. It's true for all behaviors, whether it's suicide, if a parent commits suicide, if a parent has been alcoholic. Right. So there's role modeling in all those cases. If a parent has been abusive in any way, their offspring are more likely to be either victims of abuse or be perpetrators themselves. I work with women, some of whom have been incest victims. And what they've often said to me is they worry that the partner they're going to choose in life, their husband or boyfriend, with whom they have children, or who might be the stepfather to their children, that they'd be like more likely, they're fearful that they're going to choose somebody who's an offender. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, there seems to be an effect of incest survivors, particularly, who have, very strong symptoms of post-traumatic stress, who are sort of targeted by a certain kind of sex offender.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the same pattern is repeated with the children, and their post-traumatic stress symptoms then make it difficult for them to be vigilant. One of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress is a tendency to try to avoid anything that reminds you of the original trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a strong tendency to dissociate.
That's right.
So
That's right.
You often see this pattern.
And confusion. Confusion about what's right, confusion about what's wrong. I might add that anyone listening tonight, if you find this topic very challenging and upsetting, turn the radio off or go to another station. You don't have to listen to it. I just, warn, because sometimes with unhealed wounds, I'm just talking about it can be very, very difficult. A little background on the people in your program, which isn't necessarily exact type of person who commits sexual offenses, because only some people will be convicted and go to prison. But tell me a little about those people. Do you have any women sex offenders in your program?
I currently don't. The Department of Corrections is planning on starting a program for women. In one of the prisons.
Somewhere.
Yes.
For women, because there'd be just such a small number of women compared to males. At least that's the data I remember. It's very tiny, the women sex offenders compared to male sex offenders. Are abusers of adult women and abusers of children in the same treatment program?
Yes. I include them both into the same sort of clinical approach.
Okay.
Some programs, and when I ran a program in Columbus, Ohio, we did separate, you know, pedophiles at one point, very high-risk pedophiles.
Yeah.
And but I don't have that population size to be able to do that here.
I understand.
Or the resources. But.
Right, right. Age, how old are these fellows?
They vary from age 21 to 85.
Wow. And socioeconomic background?
All socioeconomic backgrounds, racial groups.
Education?
And education levels.
Really?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. One thing, we know that the prison population has a disproportionate number of people with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And so I'm wondering what you have noticed in the sex offender treatment program with people with FASD.
Yeah, I think I've heard the figure that about as many as 50% of people with fetal alcohol syndrome, the males, have committed a sexual offense.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not an expert on that area, so I'm
what
not
do you
sure
do?
If that's accurate.
Do you screen for intelligence level for FASD? How do you have a group that really benefits from the treatment?
That is a challenge. When I ran the program in Columbus, I was able to provide a lot of support, and I would also I have a program for the mentally disabled, mentally ill sex offenders, and also for the developmentally disabled sex offenders.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a full-time tutor who would help them with their assignments. So here I have to use other resources. I've used the some of the education staff at the prison, and I've had to do much more individual work with the two FAS cases that I have.
Because one of the impacts, usually, of FASD is a lack of consequential thinking, the inability to alter one's behavior due to consequences. And so with your guess figure estimate of 50% of individuals with FASD may commit sexual offenses, you can see why. Because these poor souls who've had their brains damaged by maternal drinking during pregnancy simply would not get it. They wouldn't understand what was going on. This is kind of a general question, but my clients always ask me this who have been victims or have family members who have been victims of especially incest, but also rape. What kind of person is most at risk for becoming a sex offender?
Sex offenders are a very diverse group. They have certain characteristics, however, that make them more at risk. They have cognitive distortions, and often that are sort of sex offending, sort of promoting.
Like what? Like.
Well, like a pedophile may think that it's not very damaging to have sex with a child, that they actually learn something from it, that, you know, it's not something that is bad.
Yeah.
And there are a number of those kinds of distortions that sort of contribute to sex offending.
Mm-hmm.
Then some of the other characteristics are social, interpersonal, and intimacy deficits.
Right. I can see that.
Victim empathy deficits.
Yes.
They often have empathy in other areas, but when it comes to the victim, they have real problems with the sort of a breakdown in their empathy.
And just a comment. My last show with Gary Weglers, we were talking about this new information about epigenetics, where a gene may not be expressed with an infant who's severely abused or neglected, an empathy gene, a mirror neuron. So there can be actual brain damage after birth if a child is growing up in an abusive or neglectful family situation that alters them genetically. And, you know, we observe attachment disorder, but attachment disorder also sometimes includes the inability to empathize. And I know when I was at University of Washington and I was just touching in on the early sex offender treatment programs, the scary thing was, you know, understanding about people who do not have the capability of empathizing with the suffering of their victims.
Right. Yeah. I have read some of that literature, and there is also a high correlation between brain injury and sex offending.
Oh, I could see that. I could see that. Yes. Because sometimes there's a confusion, especially with adopted children who may have FASD or are suspected of having FASD. If you don't have their early infant history, if they were adopted when they were older, you don't know if it's brain damage from a fall. It could be, you know, a severe concussion that maybe impacted the prefrontal lobe and mimics a kind of FASD deficit, right?
Yes.
Anything else you can think of that may be precursors to sexually acting out in terms of offending?
Well, there's also some indications that, of course, drugs and alcohol play a role. High testosterone levels can be indicated in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Addiction to pornography.
Addiction to pornography. Is there any research about addiction to pornography and its correlation with being a sex offender, acting out?
Many of the kind of sex offenders who are very sort of withdrawn and deficient in social skills, who, you know, have that kind of addiction going, are often at higher risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine that. This is a pretty heavy topic for us on our show tonight. But next month, I'll be interviewing Pat White, and we'll be talking about mindfulness practices and psychotherapy. So it won't be quite as disturbing. But we still, it's an important topic, what we're talking about tonight. And Mac and I encourage you to call in at 463-6425. And you can either get on the air, dictate a note, or email jeff@k2.org. And we have a wonderful technician who's just learning how to get the phones on the air, so I think she'd like a little bit of practice here tonight, and that's Martha Moore. Thank you, Martha, for coming in and being our technician tonight. I really appreciate it. Matt, there's a whole spectrum of sexual offenses that may or may not get offenders arrested and convicted. What in the spectrum of offenses, which ones usually end up? What kind of sex crimes get prosecuted?
Well, the two most prevalent ones would be sexual abuse of a minor and sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
Another very high one would be exhibitionism.
And that is? Yeah, of course, that's a crime. Would they ever be in prison for exhibitionism?
Yes.
Okay. So you would have in your group perhaps exhibitionists?
I have. Okay. I have in the past, yeah.
Okay.
And then another one is either purchasing or viewing child pornography.
Okay. And are some of those at men at Lemon Creek?
I have one that I recently did a conference on to possibly include in the program.
And state laws vary, don't they, so that what is prosecutable in one state may not be in another?
I think with the Adam Walsh Act, that they're pretty much getting to be more uniform in their sentencing. Mm-hmm. There are still differences in the sentencing code state to state, but for the most part, they cover the same criminal.
I think code. I asked you at lunch about a certain offense that, and you said, well, that wouldn't be prosecuted in Alaska, but it would be in another state.
Well, I thought about that afterward, and I thought that in Ohio, they have a code called sexual imposition, which mm-hmm. is kind of
that's
a broad
right.
kind of...
That's right.
And that is actually more along the lines of sexual abuse of a minor.
Okay.
So, yeah, that case is... That kind of crime is still... Or that kind of behavior is still difficult to adjudicate.
Okay. I'd just like to tell our listeners that I am Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and in the studio with me is Malcolm... Nichols, Mac, the sex offender treatment specialist at Lemon Creek Correctional Center, and we are talking about the causes and the treatment of sex offenses. And now that we're more than halfway through the program, I think it's time to have a little bit of music and take a break.
Thank you.
Oh, welcome back to our show. My name is Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and in the studio with me is Mac Nichols, who is the director and clinician at Lemon Creek Correctional Center with the Sex Offender Treatment Program. And we just had an email that with a question, and I'm going to have to ask Mac this. Mac, what are the contributing factors to crimes such as indecent exposure? Okay, so it's kind of like what we've been talking about. What, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, there are two kinds of exhibitionists. The shocker and the exhibitionist who believes that if he displays his genitalia to another person, they will fall in love with him or her.
It's interesting. Years ago when I was a therapist in Seattle, I worked with a very, very successful, somewhat prominent businessman. And what he would do would be he would cruise I-5 and get next to a car and while he was driving, and he was alone, and expose his genitals. And it reminded me a little bit of another kind of disorder, two other kinds of disorders I've worked with, shoplifting and bulimia, and here's why. He spent a lot of time thinking about and preparing for this event. It was a way for him to distract himself, which shoplifters do. Compulsive shoplifters often think about it a lot during the day. It's a way to divert their thinking, sort of an obsession, and certainly bulimics will often plan out their binges.
Yeah, there are certain similarities. There seems to be a tendency to sort of draw themselves out of like a zero state or a very sort of low psychological state.
Yeah.
By engaging in the behavior.
It's kind of like high risk. Well, part of his behavior, which is the same as what we're talking about, indecent exposure, flashers, was the risk, the thrill. I mean, bringing him, it's sort of like, brought him out almost like alive out of a depressed state.
Right.
And you've seen that as
well. Yeah, there's a very high rate of relapse and reoffending involved in with indecent exposure.
Well, you know, then we get the whole spectrum, and of those, we won't call them sexual offenses, but sexual misconduct, as we've had in the news by politicians who do all sorts of things that may get them divorced, but it's certainly not going to put them in jail, right. And they lose their high-status positions. And these are all compulsive sexual behaviors, and it's all on the spectrum. The spectrum,
yes,
of engaging in high-risk, in this case sexual behaviors, to somehow meet some kind of emotional need.
Yes, we've certainly seen, you know, a growth in the kind of that kind of behavior over, you know, like text messaging and, you know, with the various kinds of media over the internet.
Yes, yes. What do you think about the good touch, bad touch programs that are in the schools, in some schools? What do you think about that?
I think they're very good. I think that prevention is very important. Very important to teach kids to say no and to be able to recognize abusive behavior.
Yeah. They were very controversial several years ago, many years ago. I remember going to school board meetings because many people opposed them. But what was interesting is, I'll never forget this, a woman who I didn't know stood up to testify, and she was very eloquent. And she said she had been a victim of early childhood abuse. And if they had had good touch, bad touch programs in the school, it could have saved her from that. What I do find with victims of sexual abuse, huge difference if they've had parental recognition, assuming it's not a parent who's the offender, but that if the offender's the father, an uncle, or a grandfather, that the mother and other relatives believe the child, and that she gets treatment, and she gets care, and she gets counseling. It's made a huge difference. Sometimes I work with people where, sort of incidentally, I'm working on some other issue, and incidentally, they say that they had experienced sexual abuse as a child, and I said, well, how do you feel that's going? They said, oh, I got in therapy right away. I think I've dealt with that. So that's really wonderful to hear. Another completely different issue is the sex offender registry and what happens to sex offenders after they're out of prison. And there's the Miami-Dade County problem that you and I discussed. Coincidentally, my house guest this summer from Miami, who happens to be a neurologist, is writing a book because he's acted with ACLU, because he told me something about some of these prisoners, some of these men, I guess they're mainly men, who have been released, are now huddled under a bridge because of the strict laws in this area. That's one specific case. What do you think about the whole, what should we do with sex offenders when they're released?
Well, I believe that registration is a tool. I think that some of the, sort of exclusion zones, or how many feet from a school or a daycare center or a park or amusement park, I think, like in Dade County, where they went too far with that, resulting in problem with housing,
right,
can be, have the opposite effect of what you're wanting. I mean, we're wanting to manage sex offenders in the community. We're also wanting them to be able to get out and lead, reasonably normal lives, where they can
right.
find housing and they can find employment. So part of their rehabilitation involves their capacity to be able to achieve some kind of capacity to be, for a life.
For a life, because one would assume, and just from my mental health perspective, the more you marginalize and stigmatize and demonize a person, whether it's because of racism or whatever prejudice occurs, it would be like wearing the scarlet letter. And I would think that the more stigmatized the person is by society, the more likely they are to reoffend, because they just have less of a life going. They have nothing left to lose.
Yes, I agree with that. When you already have many deficits in your life and you have the legacy of being a felon, and you add all that, the restrictions of, the registration and your the need to be able to, sort of form relationships and to be able to be honest. All those can be difficult when you have that kind of stigma.
Right, right. What about the sex offender registry? Do you think it protects the community from future sex offenses, or do you think it's just a reaction?
Well, again, I think it's a tool. I think some parts of it are good. I think that it's been a steady sort of legal response to some very notorious cases, like the Jacob Wetterling case, which started it in 1994, then Megan's Law, which expanded it.
Could you tell us what was the result of the Megan's Law, for example?
Megan's Law resulted in notification to the community.
Oh, that's...
So Jacob Wetterling just did the registry.
Yeah.
And so now we have the Adam Walsh Child Safety and Protection Act, which many states right now are having to enact fully by the end of this year, or they'll lose funding.
What happened?
In various areas.
What is
and that? And that also adds more conditions to the public notification, sending out letters to people in the area with a picture of the offender and so on.
Oh, how to balance politics with prevention and with true rehabilitation. Because the politics and the anger and the sensationalism might work against us. It might just be the thing that makes things worse. And but people get angry and they pass laws that may not be in the best interest of the community, let alone compassionate to the person who's just been released from prison.
This is one of the things that I focus on in my program. I try to prepare them for this kind of eventuality, and we actually will role play, you know, different kinds of responses to certain situations that they may find themselves in. And so they usually get out and they're prepared, and that's much better than not being prepared.
Yeah. One thing I worked on when we started Rape Relief was really examining the social attitudes towards women and really wondering about, in, you know, culture to culture, that the more equality between the genders, the more equality between men and women, would that decrease the incidence of rape? What do you think?
Well, it's hard to say. One of the facts about rape is that it's often done by somebody you know in about 79% of cases.
Mm.
So there is a lot of, you know, hostility towards women involved in some rapist typologies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the anger rapist. It often involves power and control, mm-hmm. and anger towards women.
Okay.
Whether there's been studies whether, you know, changes in gender roles have, you know, worsened this or made it better. It's hard to say at this point.
Well, because we were talking earlier whether punishment reduces, because the punishment that occurs not only in prison but after prison release, does that decrease? Because that's the point. It's not just to protect the community. It is also to be a deterrent to behavior.
There are many studies on the recidivism rates and how recidivism can be lowered by certain kinds of you know, procedures like I identified in the containment model.
Yeah.
So another kind of approach that is helpful is while they're in the institution, involving them in some kind of a therapeutic community in which, you know, the criminal code is no longer there and they're able to begin learning, you know, much more positive values and communication, you know, assertive communication. My program currently is a partial therapeutic community.
Hmm.
And so although the criminal code still exists on the mod where I work, it is much less prevalent than it is on the other mods at the prison.
I'm wondering if some cases of not stranger rape are more likely to be impacted by changing and positive attitudes towards women and female sexuality. Back when we were starting Rape Relief in Seattle, there was a very well-publicized gang rape in New Bedford, Massachusetts. I believe it was New Bedford. I'd once worked and lived in New Bedford, so it stuck in my mind. And it was the case where a woman had gone out late at night to get a pack of cigarettes, and the only place that was open was a bar. And she walked in, and she was gang raped on the pool table. And at that time, and this is a long, long time ago, a lot of debate about whether she asked for it. Because somebody said she was, you know, she had a low-neck blouse on, and what's a woman doing out in a bar? How stupid can you get? You're asking for it. And the comments that came from the public, and I'm not sure if they were quotes from the men that were accused of the gang rape, but it was, hey, if a woman asks for it, she gets it. Maybe none of these men in any other circumstance would rape a woman. They wouldn't be like the guy who's the Green River murderer or hanging out in Hyde Park or someplace. We're both from Chicago, so I could say Hyde Park. That's in Chicago, not in London. Hang out in Hyde Park and do a stranger rape, but they felt entitled at that time. Rape occurs during war. A lot of rape occurs during war. There seems to be certain degrees of permission where women are treated terribly, as in war, as in sexist societies, that would give men who would not be normally rapists, shall we say, the permission to do so. Does that seem reasonable to you at all?
I remember reading about that case. It was before I was in the field. There was another earlier disturbing case that occurred in New York City, I think in 1964, in which a woman was raped in broad daylight and was screaming, and nobody responded.
Right.
So, you know, that kind of response is always kind of shocking and surprising. So, yes, in cases of war, certainly there have been, you know, quite higher incidents of rape. When one thinks of, you know, what happened during the Second World War, during the final days of, like, the fall of Germany.
Oh, the fall of Berlin. Oh, right. My God. Yeah. Soldiers raping. So, it was right. It was just very, very widespread. Right. And these men, under other circumstances, may never have done something like that. But they were given permission as the spoils of war. And so I would think that social attitudes, particularly social attitudes about women, sexism, would impact whether or not there'd be marital rape, whether or not there'd be date rape, whether or not there'd be these kinds of rape that occur, like in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Well, I think, you know, in many rapes, there is a power issue going on, and people then are sort of intimidated by that.
Yeah.
So I think that was probably what may have been happening in that New Bedford situation.
Well, also attitudes towards women, like women are asking for it. You know, that women who, you know, wear low-cut dresses or short skirts, that they deserved it. And I actually have worked with a handful of women over the decades I've been a therapist where they have internalized those views and have questioned it. I remember one young woman was on vacation in the Caribbean, and she met a guy, local guy. He invited her back to his apartment. She's like 19, and she went completely innocently, and he raped her. And, oh, it was very difficult to get her not to blame herself, because people would roll their eyes, like, how could you be so stupid? And we worked long and hard saying, of course you've learned something that has nothing to do with whether you asked for it, whether you caused it, whether you're responsible, any more than if I forget to lock my car, somebody breaks in and steals the stereo equipment. I'm not responsible for their crime. I may want to lock my car, but I'm not responsible. So it's really hard, because these views get internalized. They also get internalized by incest victims, too, because frequently the offender will be telling the victim that it's for her own good that he's doing this, and don't tell anybody, and you seduced me, sort of thing. I'm sure you deal with that in your groups,
yes,
which
I
is
do.
Blaming the victim.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
Yeah. So that must be a big component, is to take responsibility.
Definitely. That is the central part of sex offender rehabilitation.
Yeah. Is to take responsibility and realize that you've harmed another person.
Right.
And probably to try to develop some ability to empathize and remorse at the crime.
Right.
Well, listen, we've got just 1 minute left, and I want to thank everybody for tuning into a very difficult topic tonight. I'll be hosting another program on Monday evening, September 5th at 7 p.m. And I'll be interviewing Pat White, a well-known Juno therapist, and we'll be discussing the integration of mindfulness practices into psychotherapy. And I want to thank you, Mac Nichols, for being here tonight and really sharing your expertise. We're very lucky to have, I'd say, the Department of Corrections is very lucky to have you here in Juneau. You've got the background and the expertise that we really, really needed here, because I have been familiar with the efforts of the Sex Offender Treatment Program. And I would like to thank our technical support, Martha Moore, who didn't get much of a chance or any chance to answer the phone tonight, but we'll give her another chance again. And Jeff Brown, who's been her trainer and backup. Usually we have John and Dolly Kramers, but they weren't available tonight. So I want to thank all the technicians who all come in, because that I am technophobic, who come in and volunteer at K2. Good night, everybody.